we talk Andy Warhol for a minute?
I would love to. What's the first thing, when you think about Andy Warhol, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
It's funny because I was going to ask you that, and it's Campbell's soup. Tomato soup.
Campbell's soup, yeah, definitely that. For me, it would be that magnificent tan that he always had. He's always very tan.
Natasha Frazier-Cavazzoni is on the line with us. Am I saying your name right, Natasha?
Absolutely.
Welcome, and thanks for joining us. You've written a book, After Andy, Adventures in Warhol Land, and I'm kind of pretty sure you're the one to write this because you were the last person hired at Andy Warhol's studio before he passed away in 1987. Is that correct?
Absolutely, and I first of all like to emphasize it was a visit to the Art Institute of Chicago.
Wow.
That inspired me to write this book because I saw the giant Mao and I thought I suddenly remembered everything. So it's wonderful talking to you.
That's excellent.
I just went to the Rolling Stones exhibitionism display at Navy Pier, and of course there's amazing works of art by Andy Warhol when he did portraits of Mick. Everyone has a story or a thought in their head. I think of Marilyn Monroe all the time. As I mentioned to Bill, I always think of tomato soup when I hear of Andy Warhol. He was a pretty amazing guy.
He was extraordinary. He was a prophet. He got everything. He was a precursor for, social media. Do you think that when I met him, I was 16 and he had a camera in his hand and a tape recorder in the other? And the camera, he wasn't looking through it. And I said, Andy, perhaps you should look through that. He was also taping our conversation. I believe he called his tape recorder my wife.
Oh.
You got to admit, as Bill mentioned, he had a great tan.
Yeah.
And he was very eclectic, to say the least.
Yes. I have to say, so much has been written about him. I found him terribly positive. I believe it's a quote you... The first time written, actually, in my book, After Andy, I've got to keep the lights on. That's something that Andy said continuously to the young men and women who worked for him. You know, when he went out to Studio 54, he always had the pile of interview magazines in hand. He was always working, thinking, making money. Making money to him was another art.
Explain this to me, Natasha, because I never understood this about Andy Warhol. Is that you would see him everywhere. He was at parties at Studio 54. He was wherever the elite would meet. He was in the center of that. But he seemed painfully shy. How could you be both?
I think you can be. I think he really was. I think he was amoeba-like in the way that he was very, you know, after the assassination attempt, you can imagine he was very, very wary of anyone coming near him. Yet, he had this incredible curiosity. I think Andy's curiosity and work ethic motivated everything else. He really had. I mean, when I spoke to him, I couldn't believe his references. There was no G or great, which he used as a sort of self-protective thing. He was very curious.
Yeah.
And so, yes, he was shy, but his need to know was stronger, which I find extremely admirable.
You know, it's weird. Art is kind of something that gets a reaction out of you, and Andy Warhol's art does that for me. Although, when you think about it, it's just very simplistic.
Absolutely. But it's like everything. And actually, I was inspired by this when writing my book. You know, Andy's work is as light or as layered as you want, because he was this incredible technician. And he made it look easy. I think that was Andy's problem. You know, at one point, the art establishment turned against him because they said he's trite because he made it look easy. And yet we look now, and it's timeless, which really is another sign of his brilliance or genius, to push it further.
Go back for just a second, Natasha. Something you just said was a question I was going to ask you at some point anyway, but since you brought it up, the art world did turn on him. He had such high reviews early on, and then there was kind of a shifting of gears, and a lot of art critics said some very awful things about him and his work. How did that affect him? Was that bothersome to him?
Well, that's what I find admirable. Of course it hurt him. And in his diaries, published in 1988, the more interesting stuff was the Andy Agonistes, where he says, why do people take his contemporaries, sorry, I'm having a Flag, the artist. Anyway, why did they take his Jasper Johns more seriously than me? Why does he have many more collectors? They did turn on him.
They did.
They turned on him after he was assassinated in the assassination attempt in 1968. The art establishment felt that he had, dried up. He didn't have ideas, and that's when his business manager Fred Hughes said, "Let's do Europe." And Angie's first retrospective was in Sweden,
mm-hmm.
not in America, to give an idea.
All right. I was just reading that was Andy Warhol's birthday yesterday, the 6th?
Absolutely. He would have been
89.
Wow. Hard to imagine.
It is hard to imagine that. And people went to Bethel Park to write things on his what would have been his 89th birthday. He was a Pittsburgh native, grew up in Oakland, attended Carnegie Institute of Technology, now Carnegie Mellon University, moved to New York where he started as a commercial artist, which really, I'm sorry I didn't know that, but it totally makes sense knowing that now.
Sure, yeah. Would it be...
He started in shoes. I mean, he did all these, amazing. If you look at his illustrations now, he was the most fantastic draftsman. And only a draftsman could have made magic with images of Jackie Kennedy, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis. If you think when he died, Elvis was $400,000, and now it's probably 80 to 90.
Wow. Natasha, would you put Andy Warhol in that bracket? There are certain people that are better as observers, and it just seemed like with the way he would always have a camera and always be interviewing people, he almost liked being an outsider looking in than being part of the picture himself.
I think, yes, I think he liked that. I think he liked being outside in order to observe. It was a sort of rolling camera, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But what Andy had was this incredible nose or flair for people. He could look. A lot of people see things and don't edit. He edited. He realized what would work and what wasn't, and what wouldn't work, which I find, considering his daily life was extraordinary. I would be exhausted. I mean, just one day I'd be flat out on the carpet.
I'm sure at some point you've noticed this. I noticed this early on about Andy Warhol's work. A lot of it is repetitive. I don't mean that in a bad way, but he'll take an image and just keep duplicating it with a slight color variation or something. What was behind that, do you think?
Well, I think he started. It was a revolution, that. It was a revolution. Now we see it everywhere. Now we see it everywhere. We see it in fashion, in advertising. I think he was trying out things.
Yeah.
I think everything was a tryout. If it worked, and what I find really admirable regarding your question about being attacked by the critics, and he was attacked, is he carried on. There was no sort of lying in bed, I can't. He carried on. It was that work ethic. I've got to keep the lights on. To him, you had to sell. Business was another art.
Yeah.
Which, I just find very modern and non-self-indulgent.
We're talking to Natasha Fraser-Cavazzoni, and the book is called After Andy, Adventures in Warhol Land. I was watching the now-canceled HBO show Vinyl, and Andy Warhol, there was a character who played Andy in here, and he was hanging out with the whole scene, hanging out in some instances where it looked like he was in bed with people, but now, is it true that he remained a virgin?
I can't answer that. My book, remember, because I was born in 1963 and I met him in 1980. My book really deals with the sort of latter decade. I mean, you've got incredible books dealing with the factory years, the 1960s. What I think is interesting about my book, or relevant, it really deals with what hasn't been written about before. His years in Europe, his English muffins, that was well-born English women who worked in the factory, and then his impact now. So I sort of deal with everything that isn't the 60s.
Natasha, what do you think is the biggest misconception about Andy Warhol?
That he was unkind.
Yeah, because that was featured in Vinyl too. There were some times where he was kind of bitchy in a way to other people, but he wasn't.
No, I think he was. I think Andy was amoeba-like. Like I said, I think he was very, very self-protective. I mean, he was no saint, but I think he was very kind to people. All the young people I spoke to, you know, or even Bob Colicello, who worked for him in the 70s and 80s, said, you know, Andy gave us more than we gave him.
Yeah. Did he understand the role he plays in the history of pop art? Does he understand the appreciation that we all have of him, or was that lost on him?
That's a very interesting question, because Andy, who, as we know, liked money, used to refer to his 60s pop art as his rainy day paintings, i.e. they were sure sells. So he knew his place. But, like many an artist, like people I've worked with, such as Karl Lagerfeld at Chanel, he was interested in the future. He was looking forward. He wasn't looking back. There was no nostalgia about his creative work.
I have some information here that, you know, you consider Andy Warhol's work as very brightly colored and really jumps out at you. But did he also paint some darker subjects like plane crashes and things like that?
Yes. I mean, they were incredible. Yes, they were dark. It wasn't all the jolly colors. But what was interesting about him, he also did jolly colors with the atomic bomb. And, you know, he was mixing, he was trying things out, and it caught one's attention because, yes, he was using these pop colors, and yet, yes, he was capturing that anguish.
Even if he did a painting of an electric chair, was that brightly colored or dark and dismal?
Well, he's done a series, so there were blues, there were lots of different colors. I mean, he caught that time in America. It's hard not to look, I find, to look at those electric chairs, all those car crashes, all Jackie Kennedy at the funeral looking Mary Magdalene-like, and not feel an emotion, a strong emotion.
And a lot of the prints had repeats, you know, there were several versions of the same picture over and over again, and there are reports, too, that Andy took that into his personal life and had a body double. Do you know anything about that?
Meet his body double. I think one was enough.
I guess.
But with his wigs, I mean, one of my favorite stories in the book is a woman coming into his Paris apartment, the only apartment he had outside of America. And she walked in and she saw the lineup of like 12 different wigs, and they were all cut differently.
Really?
Yes. It wasn't just one wig. What I find interesting, because Andy was very Catholic, is when he met the Pope, he wore a very like normal, sort of very low-key wig. Whereas when he did his fright wig, those amazing self-portraits, he wore a mad Fiorucci kind of punky wig.
They all look the same to me, to be honest with you. I always envision his hair looking the same all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what about this? When I met him, just to give you an idea of my eccentric relative, I didn't realize it was a wig.
Oh, wow. Wow. Natasha, when I was growing up, if you wanted to read the definitive interview of anybody, you had two sources. The Playboy magazine interview was always really well done, and the interviews in Interview magazine were always incredibly well done. You really got to the base of whoever that person was. How did that come about, the magazine? I mean, I know he was a great artist almost immediately, but how did that magazine evolve?
Well, it was going to be an extension of his work. And he was very lucky because he had this brilliant young guy, Bob Colicello. I mean, the early Interview magazines are pretty, a bit like sort of reality TV.
Yeah.
I mean, the worst type of reality TV. And then it was Bob Colicello, who was a film student, who took it in hand and made it interesting. But every time there was an interesting piece, Andy would say it was too interesting.
Really?
He wanted to keep it bland. He was in 2017.
Yeah.
He was not in 1970s. I mean, again, I did have a column interview, but in 1988. And they certainly started that, both Playboy and Interview, you know, that way, that interview question and answer, which no one else did.
Right, right.
Well, I'm completely intrigued. I haven't read it yet. We just got it in, but I will be. It's called After Andy, Adventures in Warhol Land. Natasha Fraser Cavassoni. You can get this where favorite books are sold. Amazon, I would imagine. And do you have a website?
Oh, I would also love to push your wonderful independent bookstores like Barbara's Bookstore, yep. Newbury Library, Hudson Booksellers, and if I'm pronouncing this right, Ricker's Park Secret Agent, and lots of fantastic books. You know, I love my mother, the writer Antonia Fraser, loves Chicago because she's always had a, you read. She always says, people in Chicago read. It's the most fantastic city. So let's push those marvelous independent bookstore.
Anderson's as well, that there are several locations. Bill and I often talk about the lack of bookstores where you could just go and browse and physically touch the book and pick something good. So hopefully people will pick up After Andy. Do you have a website for people who want to get in touch with you?
I'm on Instagram, and it's called Ticklish Tash, because I only post things that tickle me. Ticklish Tash. Or, of course, I'm on the Penguin Random House author site.
Ticklish Tash for Natasha Fraser Cavassoni. Thank you so much. Pleasure to talk to you.
Great pleasure. Pleasure all mine too.
Thanks, Natasha. Have a great week. All right, we'll take a quick break and then we have a lot more show for you. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder on WGN.